Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhoven, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhoven. There's nothing like a good lobster roll from Maine. It's like a seasonal rite of passage. And now, with opening day at Fenway coming next week, and with summer right around the corner, my mouth starts watering with this lightly toasted hot dog bun, overflowing with delicious knuckle and claw meat. I'm so ready for that. Now, some folks like theirs with tons of mayo. Others like it with drawn butter. I like mine with a small amount of both, so with some salt and pepper. That's it. Simple, straight to the point, and amazing. Talk about satiation. Man, a kick-ass Maine lobster roll with an IPA while watching Chris Sale spin a gem makes me proud to be from the Northeast. And an earnest New Englander who has gone through another cold winter that deserves his spoils. Right? I mean, this is what we all deserve. See, when I was a kid, my grandfather used to tell me about lobsters in abundance when he was a younger man in New Bedford. He'd refer to them as trash fish, and he loved every part of it. Not just the knuckle and claw meat, and not just even the tail smothered in butter, but the roe, which is the red eggs, and the tamale, which is the green stuff that happens just right above the tail when you split it open. Those were his favorite parts. We spent many a summer days visiting my grandparents on Buzzards Bay, which is a section of Massachusetts near Cape Cod, and those nights that he and my father would steam up a New England clam bake were so memorable. After devouring the New England clam bake, which would consist of a lobster or many lobsters, little necks, quahogs, butter and sugar corn, and potatoes, all steamed with a small amount of beer, I fondly remember chewing on those little tiny lobster legs that were like Twizzlers in your mouth. In fact, I think I remember that the beer we would use to steam it was Old Milwaukee, because I think I remember the tagline, "It doesn't get much better than this." Even as a young guy, it seems to stick out in my mind. Talk about some good marketing branding. It's classic Americana. But what I didn't realize at the time, in the 1970s and 80s, is that lobster, and nearly all of the New England clam bake, consisted of what was considered to be seasonal trash fish. The bivalves were all the water filters and the bottom feeders of the lobsters and crabs were the vultures of the oceans. Things have obviously changed. They're surely not a food of desired lifestyle choice like lobsters and oysters have become. In fact, going back a few years before that, when the first European settlers came to the Northeast, there were so many lobsters that they would wash ashore in piles 2 feet deep. On small boats called smacks, smackmen would pull 3 foot and 30 pound lobsters from the waters by hand. And for centuries, these lobsters were referred to as poor man's protein. It's fascinating. And just to add some more morsels to set the stage for our conversation today of this unique and delicious bug that scavengers the ocean's bottom. Well, did you know that a lobster's brain is located in its throat, its nervous system's in its abdomen, and its teeth is in its stomach, and kidneys are in its head? And lobsters hear from their legs, and they taste from their feet, and they can be right clawed or left, and they have a claw that they actually favor. That's something to think about the next time you sit down for a ball game, an IPA, and a perfectly prepared lobster roll, whichever your preference. Today we welcome a guest who could be considered a modern-day smack man, surely a Renaissance man who has built an impressive business by innovating where not many saw opportunity. Today we welcome the CEO and founder of Luke's Lobsters, Luke Holden. Hey Luke, how you doing?
Great, Aaron. Thanks for having me today. What an incredible history lesson. I even, growing up in this industry, I just learned a few tidbits there.
Well, there you go. How about that? I'm glad to share what I have been able to research. But yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because we all have those stories from growing up related to New England seafood, but especially lobster. There's something, you talk to any New Englander, we got a story behind that. And I think I just wanted to share mine. Let me do this if I could. I'm going to read a bit about Luke's Lobsters, and then we'll jump into some of the questions. Luke's Lobsters is a first opens its doors in the East Village, in 2009. The company brings traceable, sustainable seafood to guests across the country. They work directly with fishermen to handpick the best seafood and serve straight from the source, prepared pure and simple without the filler. They've systematically chosen partners with who uphold and commit to sourcing superior sustainable ingredients and strive to support other small businesses, many of which are based in Maine in local cities where they maintain their lobster shacks. So, Luke, let's talk about that to begin. Please, could you tell us a bit more about how you've grown this in the last 10 years and how you've been able to maintain your core values while doing so?
So I'm a third-generation lobsterman. My father was a lobsterman turned lobster dealer turned lobster processor. He actually held the very first lobster processing license in the state of Maine. So I grew up on the back of boats, in production facilities, on the docks. I had the opportunity in high school to become a sternman, get my lobster license. I built a boat. My youngest brother was my sternman. I did that all throughout college. And my parents basically said that I needed to go do something else. Otherwise, they weren't going to support that Georgetown education any longer. I was unsure what I wanted to do in my early 20s. I followed all of my friends after graduation to Wall Street. It was an easy time to become an investment banker in 2007. Not a lot of passion in that job, though. So fast forward 3 years. I was sitting at my desk on a summer Sunday afternoon. I was missing home. I went online looking for something that reminded me of home, and that was a high-quality, affordable, traditional Maine lobster roll. And there was nothing in New York City that was being served in the right price point, at the right level of service, and at the right quality point. So I started to write a business plan addressing why that didn't exist. Couldn't find an answer. So I did what most logical people did, and I went to Craigslist to find a partner to put a post up. And my partner now of 10 years, October 1st here, answered the bell. Ben was a food writer that was looking to get in the kitchen and looking to work with people. So we partnered up. I kept my day job. Ben got the first lobster shack opened up. It was a huge hit. We served 500 lobster rolls the first day. And we opened our second shack on the Upper East Side a short 6 months later. That's when I quit the investment bank. So from day one, this has been a passion project for me. My dad and I split the initial $35,000 investment 50-50. I had about $17,000-$18,000 in savings from investment banking. My father actually borrowed that money against his 401k, told me about that a couple of years after opening. And I know, it's just crazy. And we found a space that was an old consignment shop, turned it into a lobster roll slinging machine in 30 days, got all the permitting done, and got this thing open. And we had a couple of very core principles that we weren't going to bend from, and that was to treat people like we like to be treated and serve the best damn food at the best price. Hmm. And kind of fast forward, that concept has been developed more into a business term of stakeholder theory versus shareholder theory. We look at everybody in the supply chain and our guests and our teammates as partners, and we're ultimately looking to create win-wins and long-term interactions with all of our all of our stakeholders. And that simple principle of just treat people like you like to be treated has been professionalized. And a couple years ago we became a certified B Corp. I think we're actually the largest restaurant group in the world that's a certified B Corp, which is fun for us. And it's a fast forward 10 years. This is a passion project that is still a passion project. It's certainly been formalized and developed and built some, but every day I feel privileged to be working in this industry, and that goes both for the seafood industry and the hospitality world.
I want to come back later on to the conversation of moving from investment banking deal creation into some value creation that you're doing for your community. But let me ask a little bit more about the business structure that you've evolved. So as I understand it, you work with lobstermen, harvesters, and fishermen in Tennant's Harbor, Maine. Everything is processed in Saco, and then it's individually proportioned in servings that are doled out to one of your, and I might get this number wrong, but 28 domestic and 11 shacks in Japan. Why did you decide to vertically integrate the business, and were you ever tempted to waver from that approach?
So when we initially started, it was that tiny lobster shack, and it was working with Dad, who was running one of the premier lobster production facilities in Maine. And in 2012, we had a couple of these shacks up and going, and they were doing quite well. They were fun. They were making money. It was good ROIs, great people, very manageable. So as a family, we said, we don't need to be in the seafood business any longer. My dad sold his business, and we had great relationships. So we figured, hey, you know, we'll be able to work directly with primary processors and get exactly what we need. It took the short 6-8 months for us to realize that that was not the way we were going to scale this business and ultimately manage and truly just improve quality. And change the story and have a social impact as we were growing this brand. So we rededicated our business to being involved in the supply chain. So we opened up a seafood production facility in Saco, Maine, and we started to work with lobster dealers, primarily lobster dealers. We today kind of fast forward another 5 years. We are wharf owners. We are partners in projects. We are board members on founding board members, serving board members on fishermen's co-ops. We have completely got ourselves to the point where we know all fishermen that we work with, their catch goes directly to our MSC SQF Level 3 certified facility. Where half of our business goes to our shacks, the other half goes to partners like Whole Foods. We're now managing most of the lobster business for Whole Foods. And then we've got, as you mentioned, I guess 30 shacks in the U.S. and 11 abroad, 10 in Japan and one in Taiwan and one opening up in Singapore here soon. Hmm. So for us, we're totally charged up by taking responsibility and accountability for the supply chain. And I'll give you an example. It kind of sets us apart and it makes us a little insane, but also unique. Yesterday, me and a partner were up in Port Clyde for half a day. There's three co-ops that we work with. And the four of us, Luke's and Port Clyde Fisherman's Co-op, Friendship Fisherman's Co-op, and Tennant's Harbor Fisherman's Co-op, are all pitching together to build a cold storage facility. Now, there's a big crisis that's coming down the pike for the state of Maine, where there was a dramatic herring reduction. We use herring as lobster bait up here. And instead of the four of us kind of just letting the bait dealers or the industry figure out how to plug an 80 million pound bait deficit. We are investing in the bait supply chain. So we are working with bait suppliers throughout the U.S. and internationally to bring in approved baits that will have steady costs and that will be predictable so that ultimately our fishermen, A, can fish, and B, can fish at a margin. So there's a handful of these win-wins that we've found with all of our partners that end up just building better long-term businesses and stronger relationships. And there's nothing more meaningful for our brand.
Yeah, I read that the price of herring had gone up something like tenfold as far as what you're getting accessibility to that. it's a big deal for the amount of baits that are being, or traps that are being baited for your lobstermen. What are the alternatives? What are you guys looking at to bring in, or, you know, what creative new innovations are coming down the pipeline for people to look at?
So there's three primary baits. There's been herring, pogies, and redfish. We have a great relationship with a pogie business based out of New Jersey, so we can pre-order and commit to volume for our fishermen on pogies. Redfish have had a resurgence throughout North America, but are very plentiful over in Scandinavian countries. So we've been bringing ocean containers over a frozen redfish over the last several years, and we'll look to increase that. We're also working with another species right now that I have to keep confidential, but we are, what's fun about it is that it's got to go through a whole approval process, and is another win-win, because it's ultimately it's a species that we wouldn't be bothered if we overfished. So it would be great to kind of kill off this species and have it go into lobster traps.
I'm guessing it's not you out there hooking catfish by hand or something like that, but maybe something a little more modern and new wave. But you know, Luke, I asked a friend of ours what I should ask you about, and she had mentioned definitely on the same idea of the value chain and your efforts to work with the fishermen, the lobstermen, and how essential that has been. Could you share a few additional thoughts of projects you've been working on, the Tennis Harbor Fishermen's Co-op and also the Maine Aquaculture Co-op?
Yeah, so with Tennis Harbor Fishermen's Co-op, we've got a couple of fun initiatives going. Forever and a day, the price of lobster has just been determined off of pounds. So whatever you catch in pounds, you'll get paid a market price. And we've worked on bonuses that are tied to quality and handling. The reality is the better quality the lobster, the more meat yield there is, and the better tasting the lobster is. And the better you handle it, the less it dies. So there's real margin there that if everybody's incentivized, doesn't go to waste. You just need to incentivize the right behavior. We've also put some retail products on the shelf, and those retail products are co-branded with Luke's and Tennis Harbor, and Tennis Harbor gets a participatory component of sales. So I've been a big proponent of diversified income and better earning streams for the fishermen that make the choice to work with us, and we want to invest in them and make their businesses stronger. And aquaculture is definitely another avenue. Last year we teamed up with the Ocean Foundation, and a donation from us went to putting research into kelp aquaculture and trying to understand through kelp aquaculture if there is or not if there is, but how much carbon is sequestered in the growth process, and then ultimately is it a carbon positive, neutral, or negative process to grow kelp and then process it. So kelp is a great example of an aquaculture product that is complementary to the lobster fishing season for the most part. So it doesn't get in the way of gear, and ultimately it's utilizing, it's creating utility in the lobster industry, because a boat, more often than it's got mortgage and insurance 12 months a year. So if you can use your boat to harvest kelp, and really the harvest season is this time of year, April and in May, and see seed in the wintertime, December, January. So if you can increase utility with the equipment that you've already got, then obviously that's a win-win. So the other side of that is that the lobster industry has just seen exceptional growth over the last 20 years, and at some point in time that's gonna flatten out or taper off. And we'd like to be a brand that's developing real earning opportunity, whether it's through scallops or oysters on the aquaculture front. And we're still trying to figure out what that right-sized opportunity is for fishermen, but we're at least trying to be proactive in that discussion.
A few years ago, I had a chance to come visit your processing facility in Saco, and man, was I impressed by the efficiency of your staff. No wasted effort or energy or meat in the lobster. In fact, the machine that actually squeezes out the meat from those eight little walking legs was just awesome to see. It was one of the coolest things I've seen in a long time in a processing facility. But there's been a movement in all food animal production towards full carcass utilization. And just like meat, there's other things involved here in shellfish. There's the shells, the roe, the tamale, as mentioned before. So what are you doing at Luke's Lobsters to gain more bang for the buck in this full carcass utilization?
It's a great question, and we're constantly investing in this. The reality is that we're probably only... we're probably only at 60% utilization right now of a live lobster we process, and what that means is here's the process of a lobster. It comes into the building, goes into the cooler, passes through a stunner to knock its nervous system out. Then we take the claws off, take the tails off, take the legs off, separate the body from the shell. So the top shell immediately goes to compost, which is considered waste. Then the tails are grated to size and raw frozen with nitrogen. The legs are cooked, the meat is rolled, and then that leg shell is discarded to compost. The claws are grated to size and then cooked. So a thicker claw gets cooked a little longer than a smaller claw, so you reach the right internal temperature for the right period of time, so you just cook that meat perfectly. The meat is picked, and then the shell is discarded. So through that process, we still only have 60% utilization. And that also, mind you, that those bodies are cooked and then run through a deboner where we extract the body meat, and that's what's used to make our lobster bisque and lobster dip. So that process still only 60% utilization. So the opportunity for us is to dehydrate, dry the shell, and find value in the shell. So the primary component in the shell is chitin, and a further refinement of chitin is chitosan. So we've got a 5-year-long project that's been put in place to extract the chitin and chitosan out of lobster shells. And I think this year will be might be the first year that we actually have a product that we can go to market with. But even composting lobster shells is an expensive business for us. The way it works is we ultimately end up paying a carter, and then we pay a farmer to take the shell. So that waste for us, is an expensive business.
Yeah, I would guess. I mean, although buying some coast of Maine compost or lobster compost myself and using it in our garden and knowing how much we pay per cubic foot, I know there is some values to be coaxed out of there. And the other part of it is the chitin's used for nutraceuticals. Is that the opportunity that people are seeing with the shells?
It can be. So chitin's got all sorts of antimicrobial properties. Hmm. So there's nutraceuticals, which would be kind of the gold standard or the highest refinement, but there's opportunities in less refined products with chitin and chitosan as well.
Hmm. Okay. Well, speaking of gold standard, I think Maine lobster is a global gold standard. What are you doing with the rest of your compatriots, other Maine lobstermen, to continue to differentiate your brand on a global commodities exchange at this point?
For us, it is wonderful that we get to be in the world of Maine lobster. It's, while it's a commodity, it's one of the best tasting products out there. And then when you get to wrap a brand around one of the best tasting products, a brand that is one that's full of generational history and the beautiful coast of Maine and a resource that's been sustainably managed and has the results to prove it. Ultimately, I think as a third generation person in the seafood business, I think we all feel responsibility to continue to develop the brand and work hard to preserve the legacy that we inherited. So what's fun, if you were to straighten out the coast of Maine, it's longer than the coast of California, and I think there's something like 4,000 commercial lobster licenses, and on any given day there's a couple of patrol boats out there. It's largely a self-police industry because of how much pride our fishermen and dealers and processors take in preserving this pristine fishery for the next generation. So I feel privileged to be in this industry, but I also feel an obligation to continue to develop and develop the brand and develop the product and protect the product.
Yeah, from my understanding, it's the only self-regulated fishery in the entire United States. It sounded like you had some leaders in your space that got ahead of the curve and decided that you could be proactive in addressing that. What have you done with your leadership position of this differentiated brand to continue to move this in the right direction, to look forward scope? You talked about aquaculture. You talked about working with cooperatives. Is there anything that sticks out and that you want to share with our audience that we should know about what's happening with the future of Maine lobstermen and how you see your leadership position moving us in the right direction?
We're generally focused on just creating genuine relationships in this business. So as simple as that sounds, for as long as I can remember, there's always been friction between harvesters and dealers, processors, and the marketplace, and it's a confusing business. Ultimately, you buy a lobster off a lobsterman, say for $4 a pound, and it shows up in a lobster roll at that's a quarter of a pound at $17, and you sit there and you say, well, how does that work? Where's the person getting rich in that process? And the reality is that the supply chain and distribution chain is just so complicated, and the yields are. Aaron, if you bought 100 pounds of lobsters, how many pounds of meat do you think you'd get out of them?
I maybe 20, 30. I guess I'm going to take a low side on that.
It's probably 18 to 20 pounds of meat out of it. And so there's this triangle that we're always trying to balance between what derives most value for the fisherman, whether it's selling a lobster live in local markets or international markets, whether it's a processed lobster, meat, raw tails, cooked meat, or a whole cooked lobster. So there's all sorts of different avenues that these lobsters can get processed and distributed as, and all sorts of different points in time where the market appreciates this product more than the last. And what we're ultimately trying to do is build a very transparent model. We're ultimately trying to educate our guests on what the fishermen are doing and the strengths and weaknesses at the current moment of what's going on in their world. And vice versa, we're working with our fishermen to let them know exactly what the supply chain looks like, what the market is looking for or not looking for. And I think that type of vertical integration and transparency in the seafood world, which is often littered with fraud and misconception, is a story that we're trying to build. And along the way, yeah, there's real money being handled with co-branding retail products and real progress being made with founding co-ops and making co-investments with fishermen. But that's almost all that stuff is just a side effect of one of those core brand values that that we brought to the table on day one, which is just treat people like you'd like to be treated.
The golden rule. Let me talk about penetration into new markets here and looking at, I'm going to give you a bit of a long lead line here, but so there's been a trend in food production towards eating alternative proteins, and that's not just the lab-grown meat or the nut milks and fats, but from bugs. But those who are eating lobster and crabs have been eating these bugs, the scavengers of the ocean, for a long time. We have no qualms, no concerns. This is something that we're used to. And I can see the parallel or why you went to Japan. I mean, they've been working with the spiny lobster from their days in the beginning. And who wouldn't want the sweet, delicious gold standard of the North Atlantic Maine lobster, of course. And that's why you've been able to flock to your shacks in the Far East. But what about other markets that are less familiar with these bugs of the oceans, these lobsters? How can we convince diverse international markets or even folks here in the States, in Arkansas or North Dakota, that there's something pretty special about the taste, the experience, and the nutritional value of the lobsters that Luke's shacks have to offer?
You know, it's funny because I think we're getting better about educating our guests on how special our products are. Just like a quick story, when we first opened up in Boston, I was terrified. You know, there's a lot of lobster that's available in Boston and a lot of lobster rolls. And I just sort of thought, you know, hey, maybe this is a little too close to home. We were built on that concept of bringing something down in New York City that was not available and not accessible, but it is available and is accessible in Boston. And all of those fears played out very differently. The reality was that the marketplace already knew and appreciated lobster and understood what quality was and wasn't, and understood what a fair price point was and was not. And we've just done great, great business in Boston as a result of selling into an educated market. And you take Las Vegas. We opened in Las Vegas probably 3 or 4 years ago. And that shack started very slow. It took us a while to build up a routine local business. And I think a big part of that was educating on, you know, why everybody, you taste it, it's delicious, but there's an education component of why you should spend $15, $16, $17 for a lobster roll, bag of chips and a drink, when you could get a sandwich, drink and chips for 10. So there is that education component that continually drives us to be better storytellers. So tell us the authentic stories of our fishermen, tell the value of our supply chain and why we're able to offer the best quality at the best price. But it's an ongoing effort for us and one that we're excited to champion.
For my last question, I want to talk about the body of water that you're operating within. So it was reported last year that the Gulf of Maine is warming faster than 99% of the rest of the ocean. The region has experienced a 2 degrees Celsius increase in temp over the past decade. With that comes acidification, invasive species, and different living conditions for the current inhabitants. So what are you guys doing about this? And that's a broad and big question. I know the Gulf of Maine is a huge thing, but as a leader of the largest crop coming out of this, you know, where do you see your role playing in, and how do you protect this $400 million annual crop for your local lobstermen?
So last year we gave a sizable donation to the Ocean Foundation, which is working with the Island Institute to put a research plan in place to study how kelp sequesters carbon. Now, I had mentioned that earlier, but I think that's a great opportunity to understand how fishermen can have an impact on climate change. I serve on the board of the Lobster Institute. The Lobster Institute is doing a lot of research and trying to figure out how changing water temperatures affect lobsters, both from a stress standpoint, which causes mortality, from a potential, how does changing waters affect the growth cycles of lobster? Because ultimately, if we find out, let's say warmer waters make lobsters grow faster, but doesn't give them a chance to be reproductive, then maybe what we would do is increase the minimum size of lobster that we harvest. I think research can enable us to be very proactive here. So we're definitely putting our brand in the position to have a voice at the table. We're also out there doing our best to educate our guests about the impact of plastics in the ocean. Last year, we did 4 or 5 ocean cleanups in different markets, from an island up in Maine to beaches off of Maryland, where our team would gather guests from local shacks and go up and clean trash and talk about some of the issues that our local communities are facing with waste and ultimately have a lobster roll over the discussion. And so we're a group that growth and doing more sales and opening more shacks are not measures of success for us. Growth enables us, in our opinion, to have more social impact, a brand that's got a louder voice. And ultimately, we're super motivated by that.
Well, breaking bread is always a good thing to do to get things done. Breaking bread when it has filled with lobster meat, boy, great things can happen at that point. So good stuff, Luke Holden. I really appreciate you taking the time. Where can our listening audience learn more about Luke's Lobsters and Luke's Lobster Shack, and where can they find out where to get some of your lobster rolls?
So lukeslobster.com. We'll show all the locations. You can learn about the brand through Instagram or Twitter or Facebook. But we've got a brand new shack opening up in Portland, Maine, hometown for us this June that we're super excited about. We're in Boston, New York, Philly, D.C., Chicago, Miami, Las Vegas, San Francisco. And then if you're traveling over to Japan and Taiwan, we're out there as well. But we'd love it if you give it a shot, and we'd love to hear what you think. We're very proud of the food we serve and the people on our team that are building this main brand, and we're always looking for new guests. So,
well, it's great stuff. I'll close by saying, you know, moving from your first day of 500 lobster rolls, where you knew or you saw that there was a pent up excitement and enthusiasm for a quality product that you could source, to turning it into 30 domestic shacks and 11 international, and continue to grow and being the main supplier for Whole Foods, while also still looking out for your lobstermen and addressing major issues like a issue of 80 million pound deficit for your bait. Those are all essential parts that the industry needs, and the fact that you're able to vertically integrate that and still look at other macro trends of environmental issues and climate issues is a testament to your work. So, Luke Holden, I thank you again for taking the time to speak with me today. I learned a great deal. I know our listening audience will as well. So I'll just say until next time.
Thanks for having me, Aaron.